It's just about time for us to start this morning. If you would go ahead and get yourself ready for our period of Bible study as we're studying and considering the text of Genesis and the history of God's people. Before we delve into our study this morning, if you would bow your heads together with me in prayer, we'll approach our God with humbleness. Heavenly Father, we thank you for the privilege that it is to commune with you, and we hope that as we speak our hearts' desires to you, we do so with an eye towards heaven. Help us to understand your greatness, to recognize the way in which you work in our lives. Help us to value the relationships that we have with those who walk together with us in the kingdom. Let us learn to see first their strengths and then help them grow beyond their weaknesses. Help us to look inward to ourselves, to be aware and honest with our weaknesses so that we can use them in your service. We know that the teaching of God that comes through the writing of Paul, when it tells us that your strength is perfected in weakness, that's not just for Paul, it's for us. So help us become those who are willing to be weak in your sight. Help us to be faithful as we study this morning in the text of Genesis and to learn from your servants. And please forgive us of our sins. And we pray this in your Son's holy name. Amen. The text of Genesis, as we've mentioned a couple different times, this is the story of God. As much as it is the story of these individual patriarchs, the one unifying message, individual, person, factor from Genesis to Revelation is God. Sometimes when we forget that big detail, we get lost in the small details of a person's life, a certain period of the history of God's people, and we miss out in seeing what God can do and has done for all of us. Unifying the Bible's message comes down to one singular event which is repeated throughout the story of God. It's his heartfelt desire to reconcile. Reconciliation is talked about in Genesis chapter 3. Reconciliation is talked about from that point forward until the cross. After the cross, reconciliation is now talked about in the hind view, the rear view, where it says you can be reconciled, but it's still the major conversation point. So even when we're now looking at the story of Joseph, which is a larger story of reconciliation, it's still teaching us about God's plan to reconcile mankind with him, all who are willing. And so as we look at these events and the framing and shaping of Joseph, it's always with that eye towards the big story, God, the major plan, reconciliation, and God's desire to bring that about, not just for people in the book, but as we sometimes say, people of the book, and that's you and me. We're the ones who are the final participants in God's story in that sense. We look at Genesis chapter 40, and it's built on the events that take place in chapter 37 and 39. That is the disintegrated relationship between Joseph and his brothers, his tossing into the pit, and he rises from a series of loaves through humble service to both those who would be arguably his captors or his possessors, those who owned him in one sense, but also in his service to God. And that comes through time and time again in the way in which he responds. Chapter 40 lays out some of the sequences that will open up the stepping stones. This is the interpretation of two dreams. And a great reminding point from that event is that it takes about
2 years
to get from there to where he's going.
2 years.
I want you to kind of think about the impact of that amount of time. From remember me,
going back to serve, 2 years. I talked before about on Wednesday night, could you remember something that happened way back that you were upset about? Well, just think about this. Can you remember what happened 2 years ago on this day? Well, most not, probably not, because it's not memorable. It's not remarkable. But if you interacted with two men whom you interpreted dreams for, those dreams that you interpreted came out to be true, do you think that every day you could remember what you had said and the seeds that you had planted and the lack of fruit? Because that's really what's taking place there from Joseph's side. He planted a seed. He had an opportunity. And there had been no fruit yielded yet. Well, 2 years down the road, there's going to be fruit. That's where we're at right now. We're at that event, if you will, in chapter 41. We're going to get to 42 in a second. But chapter 41 lays out the sequences of Pharaoh's dreams. And we're going to pick up in the middle portion of the text, probably around verse 25. Joseph has already come onto the scene. We've already had the failures to understand, that Joseph is coming in as the last straw to solve the problem, the last seed to say, well, can you plant a new opportunity here, a new bit of information? And he's reached out to the wise men. He's reached out to the magicians, the magi, if you will. They have no answer to them. They don't even understand what's going on. So let's pick up there, verse 25, Genesis chapter 41, read together through verse 36. Tim, could you read that for us, please? Genesis 41, 25 through 36.
Then Joseph said to Pharaoh, "The dreams of Pharaoh are one. God has revealed to Pharaoh what he is about to do. The seven good cows are 7 good years, and the 7 good ears are 7 years. The dreams are one. And the 7 lean and ugly cows that came up after them are 7 years. And the 7 empty ears blighted by the east wind are also 7 years of famine. It is as I told Pharaoh. God has shown to Pharaoh what he is about to do. There will come 7 years of great plenty throughout all the land of Egypt, but after them will arise 7 years of famine, and all the plenty will be forgotten in the land of Egypt. The famine will consume the land, and the plenty will be unknown in the land by reason of the famine that will follow, for it will be very severe. And the doubling of Pharaoh's dream means that the thing is fixed by God, and God will shortly bring it about. Now therefore let Pharaoh select a discerning and wise man and set him over the land of Egypt. Let Pharaoh proceed to appoint overseers over the land and take 1/5 of the produce of the land of Egypt during the 7 plentiful years. And let them gather all the food of these good years that are coming, and store up grain under the authority of Pharaoh for food in the cities, and let them keep it. That food shall be a reserve for the land against the 7 years of famine that are to occur in the land of Egypt, so that the land may not perish through the famine."
There's a lot that takes place here, and the next verse is really going to key into a transition point. But here we now have the understood application of the dreams of Pharaoh. When we first read them on Wednesday night, those who are maybe more familiar with the Bible story or kind of recognize the history of Joseph, you're like, oh, I know what those dreams mean. Because we've already seen history pull out. We've already walked through that. But here in this moment, at this juncture, this is a pivot point again in the story of God. And that's where God uses a man, uses his creation to turn the way people see the world. And Joseph is right there on the fulcrum. He's the one who's serving under that pressure of opportunity. The famine that takes place, how many people will be affected by it? Everywhere. You think about the magnitude of an event like that. This is not just the localized famine and challenge of the first century where you saw a couple of similar events, and brethren worked together with brethren. This is area-wide. We highlighted before also last Wednesday night that God has many means to solve physical problems. And for the people of God, he had already solved the lack of food problem in the big picture of all of the story in other ways. Not prior to this event, but he's already used other means to feed his people. So there's more going on to this famine solution than that. This action, these events here, save not only Joseph, not only his brothers and their progeny, but also it changes Egypt. Because what happens to the nations around them through the process that God institutes in their nation? Because this is all God's handiwork. God told them the famine was coming, told them how to solve the famine, told them that they're poised to be prepared for the famine. But the nations that were next to them, how did their relationship change with Egypt? Yeah, they had to go to them for food. And who did that? Yeah, but next step up. God did that. God changed the landscape of the nations all around there in these actions. So we talk about how this saved Joseph and his family. But God's plans are being worked through the larger change that takes place too. If you ever want to get into the perspective of how does God work with the nations, it's as much as raising up Assyria and Babylon as much as it is here in Egypt. He changed all those nations by the acquisition of their goods. He said, all that stuff comes to us. Egypt has it all now. Egypt has all that wealth. And that also changed the Israel that was forged in that group too. Because they came in plentiful and they left out half. As runaway slaves in essence. A people running from that group. Just a good picture to see, okay, well, there's more going on. It's more than just that. Now God's working with these people in the ways that he does. It also helps us understand this. When we say, and I often will use this phrase that's pulled forth from the Psalms, that God still rules the nations, he still does. And he rules them in many ways. Sometimes with the fist, the rod of judgment, and sometimes with the blessings they receive. Because by blessing an environment, an area, well, that causes them the ability present to rise up and to be above and have to be mindful of those factors. And so the entire series of dreams is laid out for us prior to this text. And then Joseph tells Pharaoh the interpretation and application of the dreams here in this section of the text. And then we get to this powerful statement. This proposal pleased Pharaoh and all his servants. And Pharaoh said to his servants, can we find a man like this in whom is the Spirit of God? Now, how much evidence does Pharaoh have in play that we know of to drive him to that conclusion? Interpretation of the dream, and the hint back to the prior event. Because they said the baker, the cupbearer, that happened too. But we don't have this huge scope of character research. We don't know anything that goes on. I mean, is it possible there's more information that we're not privy to? Absolutely. Certainly likely. I mean, you're not going to get into the Pharaoh's throne room without some sort of scrutiny. You're going to be frisked emotionally and physically before you go in. But here he is. And their response to him is they're all pleased with it. But they connect that there's something about Joseph that is what we would call extraordinary in the Spirit of God. Tim?
It's interesting to think about that court intrigue because there's going to be a major political shift in power here through this process of the next 14 years as we go through. And yeah. Whether Pharaoh did it because he could see the vision through his own accumulation of power or not, it's a very significant change in Egypt.
Yeah, I mean, all of his servants, with Joseph's place in the story, he moves from prison to being in between the Pharaoh and all of them in the level of hierarchy and authority. He is essentially treated to the level of deference and place and prominence and specialness that's equivalent to the Pharaoh, because he receives people into his court. I mean, you think about that shift. When his brothers come, and we're looking forward a little bit with the eye towards the future, brothers come, and he doesn't even look like them anymore by the time they get there, physically, in the sense of, well, this is not good.
He has to come down to them
to see. And there's a great analogy about that when we get there, when that reconciliation takes place too.
But the plan that's laid down, this is kind of expanded on in verses 33 through 36 that we have already kind of keyed into, was that a fifth of the grain that's collected during the fat years, the plump years, is going to go into the storehouses.
That fifth is sufficient not only to take care of Egypt, but also all those nations around that will one day then bow to them. You know, you think about bumper crop season. You know, I'm not no farmer by any means, but I can understand math and how much plenty is coming into that. It's already a rich land for produce in that area. But now it's so rich that they have enough to feed all their people, save 20% of it, in essence, in the storehouses, to feed all their people and everybody else for all the years to come and to get through the second phase of the famine. That's massive. And it changes Egypt because now they become focused on a different kind of thing. It changes their culture and society to go through that kind of shift as to what's important. Many of, just to make it understandable, you think about maybe your own personal backgrounds, the way in which communities changed over massive events. World War I and World War II in particular changed U.S. culture. We shifted from a very much an agrarian farming culture before World War II to a highly industrialized culture after World War II. And then we've changed back again. And one of the illustrations of that, look at Detroit. Detroit is the illustration of the rise of industrialism and the fall of it. Well, here, that's going to happen in Egypt. They're going to rise toward this. Israel's going to be there. And then Egypt changes when Israel departs. When they leave, Egypt changes significantly, both in the makeup, in the Bible's interactions with them, but also in the larger historical side of things. Egypt changes when that event takes place too. And so in the midst of all of this, we have Joseph, who is, if you look at his resume, a slave from the Hebrews. We don't know exactly his background, because they don't. He was just sold into slavery. In jail because he was accused of rape. That's the accusation that was put on his table. I should take my own advice and turn the sound off on my phone. And so, he's a supposed rapist, and he's a convict. He's in jail. I mean, these are all facts. And now he's put in charge of essentially saving Egypt. But they don't understand all the things that we get to. They just know that this guy has the opportunity to save Egypt. And they trust it. That's another powerful thing that is amazing to me, that the Pharaoh is there and trusts God with this answer. Of course, he's already exhausted all his other possibilities. Nobody else has an answer for him as to what's going on and what could be there. So in verses 37 to 45, which is the next segment of the story, Joseph is lifted up. Rags, in essence, to riches, and he rules Egypt in a matter of moments. The only one greater than him is the Pharaoh himself. And something changes about the way in which they see him. You'll notice in verse 45, Pharaoh called Joseph's name Zaphnath-Paaneah, and he gave him in marriage to Asenath, the daughter of Potipharah, priest of On.
So Joseph went out over the land of Egypt.
Now, it's an interesting tidbit, and I want you to parallel something. We have a number of instances where Hebrews, God's chosen people, are in captivity in various ways. Some of them, for whatever reasons, we remember them only by their Hebrew names, and some we don't. There's some powerful bits and pieces of the way we understand the Bible story to catch these names. So Joseph and Daniel, do we ever refer to them in any context by anything other than their given Hebrew names? How many of you know that Egyptian name off the top? If I had said that to you, and put, I thought about putting it on the chart and said, who's this guy? And maybe if we had recently saw that passage or read through it this morning, we probably would have remembered it. But if I say Meshach, Abednego, you guys know who those guys are? Yeah. The way we think about Bible stories is influenced a lot of times in part by the way that they're written. And Joseph is never really referred back to by this name again. It kind of pops up. But there's an interesting tidbit. It was given to him. He was referred to it, but then it goes on, but he's still Joseph. The text, the very next verse. And I think that's a powerful bit about it in the way that Moses, through the work of God, as we're bringing this down. So Joseph went out over the land of Egypt. The highlight I want to make is that sometimes in life, how we're treated changes us. The titles that were given to him, the opportunity that was given to him, could fundamentally change who he was. Look, like, in more ways than we could possibly understand. And the easiest way for me to kind of show this is to talk just briefly about this one detail. Historically, those who win state-sponsored lotteries, they're losers in the long term because their lives are shattered. Without question, that great dumping of economic wealth through the decision to waste it in the lottery because you're not going to win, I can say that with great confidence. The math is against you. You know, you want to know why I don't play the lottery? Two reasons. One, I don't think it's morally right, but because of math is the second reason. Because I know I won't win. The odds are so far stacked against you. Well, everyone who wins the lottery loses. They lose their friends. They lose a sense of themselves. They lose a sense of the guideposts that drove them there. It changes them. Well, it could have changed Joseph dramatically. But I like to notice at this point, Joseph really doesn't change. Whom he is, the same young man that fled rather than be ensnared by sin, is the same one we lead ourselves to later. And it's just a great way to think about how our lives can be in those same places, because our life is going to be full of opportunities where people are going to bestow upon us title, position, authority, responsibility, opportunity. And do we let those things change us? Or do we continue to serve on the basis of whom we are through those opportunities, through those open doors? This is a great, powerful moment to see for Joseph because we can see it could happen. And the cautionary tale is somebody else. Do we know anybody else who was given all that same opportunity and it changed him greatly?
Solomon.
And Solomon had one thing that we don't see handed to Joseph. Unparalleled wisdom. The very thing we seek to get hold of the most because we know it's so valuable and necessary, God granted him an abundance of wisdom beyond the average. And it, all the things that he had, he changed. Great wealth, he used it to explore worldliness in essence. All of his testing was to test the world. Joseph, not possessing such great wisdom, stayed
constant in his faith. Cautionary tales looking at these two individuals that had both many much the same opportunities, same roles in some ways. He's also given an Egyptian wife. And a thing to think about is remember, though, that we see that level of change. He's certainly not immune to the risks there. Just because he's still referred to as Joseph doesn't mean that he had like a magic shield around him. These were day-to-day choices that he had to make to sustain his faith. In verses 56 and following is the last section of the text. And Joseph is now serving in this intended task. He's already possessed and grown and developed a character that stands apart. His commitment to God is demonstrated on a regular basis, fleeing from sin, acknowledging that the consequences would be both severe to him spiritually, on a personal level, but he would also degrade God generally. He'd be sinning against God. And so if he had committed fornication and adultery, then he would have broken the heart of God and sullied that relationship that he had and the image of God that was in all of Egypt. But he maintained that faith. He immediately goes out and gets to work. He engages in the very thing that God said needed to happen and takes the responsibility given to him by the Pharaoh in hand and really demonstrates the kind of work ethic that you and I need to develop. Put our hand mightily to the things that God gives into our possession and our responsibility. You know, whatever we do it all to the glory of God as a general truth, and that includes our work. And we're doing it to glorify him is a way to think through the process. And he'd already established this pattern of behavior in the past, and so it plays off here too. Put himself to the work, God's hand is with him, and in that 7 years of plenty, exactly what was promised comes off, and then some. And there's a multitude of blessings. An interesting thing, though, in any of this section, as he's risen to this high level, does the Bible tell us that he's sending letters back home? Yeah. Does he feel, if you were in his shoes to understand Joseph, would you feel welcome at home? Would your heart break, though? Yeah, because there's people that you miss there. But from his place, how much protection does he have around him right now? Yeah, he's got a whole army around him. If he wanted to go back there and see how his family was doing, you can imagine that he has the resources to arrive with the army of Egypt. And he does, in a very literal sense. He can do that. And from the standpoint of the world, that's a pretty worldly response. Because we come back with our big shiny belt buckle and our big boots and come back home and say, how you like me now? Right? That's a worldly response. That's not what we see happen. We don't know all the whys. We don't know the whats. We do know that that's not shown to us. Instead, there's a continued focus into what God has him involved in. His hands are involved in this work at this time. And it's a powerful bit of information to know what's not included, and that's not there. There's no hint of any of that. In fact, the only hint of this opportunity comes toward the end of the cycle, the end of the opportunity to store up before the next phase of the famine comes in. And that's really talking about verses 50 to 57 is the last section, if you will, of the 41st chapter. God's hand saves Egypt. Before Israel's even in the play, God's hands save the Pharaoh, save Egypt. For whatever reason, God needed two things to happen. One, he needed Egypt to be there, and he needed Egypt to rise above the nations around them. Because that's the two outcomes we're going to see. The first one is their salvation. Their salvation comes through the storing up of all of their possessions. Joseph, in the midst of all of that, is the deliverer and custodian of God's blessing. Because he gives the answer to the question. And he's the only one who has it. He is the only one who has the seed of knowledge that can save Egypt. There's five great lessons for us to maybe think about from the 41st chapter, and five quick points. First one's pretty obvious. We've talked about it before, and understand that hardship doesn't have a stopwatch on it.
where, well, hardship's going to last for 2 days. In this case, some of Joseph's hardship are at least 2 years. Long time. Maybe three, if you think about the full cycle of things, from when he got there until he was let free. Second factor to understand about Joseph is he was someone who deeply respected authority. Because in all of his places, it's not like he is trying to escape. Now, you think about, there's an old TV show that was pretty comedic, Hogan's Heroes. And one of the constant joke lines was how easy it was for them to escape camp. They just kind of walked out. Actual prisons in World War II were not like that. All the prison camps, no. But you look at that, oh, we just, Hogan's here, we just go out. It's not a problem, it's a big joke. Well, the difference here for Joseph, literally has no reason to be there, but never once to his actions say, let's fight it. Let's rise up. Let's have an insurrection. Instead, he serves. And that's a good sense of his perspective of authority is seen in that action. Genesis 41 and verse 4 is a great connected point to it. In each of the actions that we see, Joseph turns back to God as being the one who's actually the doer, and that he's the servant. I know what this dream means because God handles the interpretation. Men don't. Even in how Pharaoh sees him, well, the Spirit of God is with him. So in all that Joseph does in service, he minimizes himself and magnifies or glorifies God. And that's a great truth to catch from this chapter. We also don't see in the Scriptures record a great sense of bitterness. And so our hearts need to kind of lean towards actions that say in the midst of trial, we don't become bitter. But we build ourselves to become joyous, hopeful people when things aren't well. Yeah. We look at these great examples of hearts that had similar trials, maybe even more difficult trials. We know that they move forward without bitterness, so we can do the same. And one of the things that is probably underlooked, under-considered, is that Joseph's work ethic seems consistent. We find him in each of these events dutifully following the expectations of those who had charge over him. You go back to chapter 37 and 39. Go out and do this, son. And he does. Even though he's going to be heckled and hassled by his brothers, he goes out and does exactly what is asked of him. In the pit. Okay, now he's a slave. Okay, he serves. In prison, he serves. Out of prison, he serves. It's a great testimony to all of us to think about the balance of two freedoms that we have. First freedom, we live in a nation that gives us great economic freedom and the ability, in most cases, to easily choose working environments. We've got a pretty easy process. If you don't like where we work, we apply somewhere else. And she'll be hired. We just kind of, okay, go work over there. For the most part, I know I'm really kind of simplifying the process. It doesn't really work that way. But in essence, that's kind of how it goes. Great liberty there. But you and all, I also have a greater liberty. We are free in Christ. And so thinking about his work ethic, his servant ethic, in contrast to our liberties, he's constantly in servitude. That's how we see him. Even while he's still highest, save Pharaoh in Egypt, he's still a servant. Because there's still one over him who has absolute sway over his life. And all of this, he's in service to God before the old law. So before the detailed explanation of what sin is comes into play. And before the promised liberty that comes in Christ. He serves God directly and wholeheartedly. Without the kind of sacrifice that you and I have had. And so it's just kind of to see his work ethic in the midst of those things that were a lot of uncertainty. Could you imagine working in a place where you just didn't know what tomorrow looked like? Like, what's the standard for tomorrow? You're going to go to work tomorrow, and maybe tomorrow you're going to get in, they say, well, today's work day is 14 hours. And you go there the next day, and they don't need you for another 2 hours. You got to sit there and wait, and then you're going to work for 15 hours. And every day is like that, where you don't know what's going to happen. It's a way to think about the law without details. God's law without explanation. You know that God's there, and he has a standard. But what if we didn't know what the standard was? Well, under the old law, it was very clear. But before that, there's a lot of trust involved. When God asks, you simply do. And you trust. Well, God asked Joseph to do things that were extraordinary.
Any quick comments on chapter 41 before we move to the 42nd chapter? It's a big emotional change, by the way. There's going to be a lot of fulfillment to some of these things that comes out in chapter 42.
And the standard means of conversation apply. If you've got a question, you can raise your hand. If you're comfortable with it, you can speak up and just interrupt me, and that's okay, too. I appreciate it. If you have stuff you want to bring to the table, let's bring it and increase the value of our study.
Chapter 42, verse 1. When Jacob learned that there was grain for sale in Egypt, he said to his son, "Why do you look at one another?" That phrase is pretty well understood. Why are they looking at each other? Why is the idiom being brought forth? Why are they freaking out?
There ain't no food. And they're looking at each other, well, what are we going to do? You ever been there? Anytime you try to negotiate a place to go with a group of more than two people, that's what it looks like. Where are we going to go eat? And they all stare at each other. And nobody wants to make the first move. Well, that's exactly what's happening here. Where are they going to go eat? The difference is their options are pretty limited. There's only one restaurant in town. Just one. Egypt's the only place that actually has something on the menu. And so the response and action here of Jacob is a little bit kind of a little sarcasm, a little irony in some ways that we're going to see play out. But why are you even hesitating? There's no like option to this. There's no like, well, maybe we could, possibly we could. We could try this solution. It hints to that's already been their conversation. They've already moved that way. The famine was severe over all the earth, and it said in the last closing verse of 41. Verse 2, and he said, behold, I have heard that there is grain for sale in Egypt. Go down and buy grain for us there, that we may live and not die. If you're a Bible underliner, underline that term, live and not die. It doesn't, grammatically, it's like, why is it being written that way? Because we don't often converse, because living means not dying, right? They're the same thing. But there's some power to it, because there's layers to the idea of life and death, and there's layers to the ideas that we'll see play out. But underline it and connect it with a couple events. If you want to make a note, one of the notes goes back to Joseph in the pit. Left for dead, yet he lives. I left him. I mean, in many senses, they didn't think he'd make it out. And when they say go to Egypt, you know how powerful a guilty conscience is? You just watch someone who's trying to get away with something, and you put them down in a chair, and don't even ask them a question. You can see the softness of their character. If they're hardened, nothing changes. But if they're soft in some way emotionally, they've got remorse still coursing through their personality, they start sweating. And they'll confess to everything. And by everything, I mean anything that has nothing to do with the thing you're actually looking for because of the softness of the character. And so Egypt is mentioned. And Joseph's brothers, Jacob's sons, there's a connection to Egypt that's going to underscore this.
So 10 of Joseph's brothers went down, and by the way, they're Joseph's brothers again. Do you think in the big picture of things that pleases them at this point in their life to be referred to as Joseph's brothers?
They didn't like it before. Like, oh, you mean we're going to bow down to you? You're going to be above and our parents? Oh, we can't do that. But now, throughout all history, they're referred to as my gods. intentions as Joseph's brothers.
Went down to buy grain in Egypt. But Jacob did not send Benjamin, Joseph's brother, with his brothers, for he feared that harm might happen to him. Thus the sons of Israel came to buy grain among the others who came, for the famine was in the land of Canaan.
So you think about this whole entourage of humanity and the humility of mankind as they're all streaming into Egypt to buy grain. And these are the bits of the story that are going to be in the hearts of the brothers of Joseph, because if God referred to them that way, then we can too. When they realize whom they're going to deal with to get the grain to save their family. You think that's a humbling moment from folks that have sought pride in all that they do? Little Joseph, little dreamer. Kick him in the pit. Forget about him. We're good. And, you know, 10-ish years down the road, plus a few more, they're humbled with the rest of mankind, walking in essence with so little in their hands and so little in their hearts to maybe use whatever they have left so they don't die. So they are at the end of whatever rope that they have. This also puts them at, in essence, a state of emergency when they realize that it's so much a high level of importance that they send nearly all the brothers, that Benjamin's held back because that Jacob's afraid. He doesn't want him to get hurt. Joseph and Benjamin, the two sons of Rachel, would be identified in that character. We've talked about that in different ways. He's already lost one of those two. This would be the other, and it's just not something he can do. The text continues, and this picks up in verse 5 and 6, that we have about 20 years of time between the before and now. Position of a ruler. He's in a place of power and authority. And it's going to be a huge, huge journey spiritually for Joseph's brothers. Verse 6, it says, Joseph was governor over the land. He was the one who sold to all the people of the land. He was, in essence, the face of salvation. When they went into Egypt, they didn't see the Pharaoh. They saw Joseph. And in Joseph, salvation was found. You think about the way the people who Joseph interacted with saw him. Could you imagine the desperation in their families? And this guy has the solution. And what would you be willing to give to save your family? Would you care so much about your stuff and things if it meant food for your kids and for yourself? He didn't get his great storehouses because he stole it from other people either. They didn't have a warring tribe go out and take everybody else's food and bring it into the storehouse and then dole it out in small amounts to subjugate the people. They took from their abundance, and they set it aside, and they sold it. And people were willing and excited. We have food. We can live. And they have enough. They didn't run out. No squabbles, no fights. They had enough. They sold it, and they gave what they had in order to get it. And so Joseph then again is a benefactor of the salvation of Egypt and all the peoples. But their nations will change, because all that wealth that was in the nations around them, just as it was for Israel, it now flows into Egypt. And you wonder why Egypt all of a sudden in the history of mankind is just like super wealthy. Well, now you have a hint of part of it, part of God's plan. That's it for our
overall time for our class this morning. We're about to run out, so we can't get too much deeper into this section of the text as much as I would love to.
We will pick up in the rest of chapter 42 on Wednesday night. And thanks, everyone, for your participation and joining into our study this morning.